It's time for To The Last Drop podcast with Liam Del Calm and Brendan Nell.
We're back. It's week one of the World Cup. The first round of matches is gone. As you heard there, there was quite a bit of an atmosphere there. I'm Brendan Nell. Liam Del Calm's with me, and this is To The Last Drop. Liam, you recorded that. It sounded like quite an atmosphere. Where were you, and what was happening while they were belting out that anthem?
So we went too long. Initially, I was scheduled to be in Paris for the opening game, but then I thought the logistics involved with that would be a bit of a challenge the following day, because I was also scheduled to go to the England-Argentina game in Marseille. So I thought it best to sit out the opening game and wait it out in Toulon. And we found a little pub. It's a rugby pub, a rugby bar. Half a block, not even half a block, I'd say 50 meters from Stade Félix Maillot, Toulon's home ground. And the folks who support Toulon, they obviously frequent the bar, and they created quite a vibe, quite an atmosphere in that little establishment. We kind of discovered it by accident earlier in the week, and figured that is the best place to go watch the opening game, and what a good call that was. That was probably one of my better rugby memories outside of a stadium.
It looked rather festive, and I must admit there was quite a bit of FOMO from my side watching it from here. It looked like an epic place to watch it. I think let's start with just talking about, I mean, you obviously over in Toulon, you're heading off to Bordeaux today. The Box move out there to play Romania this weekend. For people who obviously don't know how rugby tours work and the logistics and that, they think you're having a nice long holiday sitting in pubs watching games, etc. They don't quite realize, and I know it's going to sound like Afrikaans, they say, you're complaining with the white bread under your arm type thing, but you are in a fortunate position to be there, but it is logistically a challenge. And just tell us how a normal day works for somebody who's covering the Springboks.
Okay, so yesterday was a little different because the team announcement, and this has now happened 2 weeks in a row, the announcement has been moved from a day engagement to a 7 p.m. Engagement, which then obviously throws your day out a little bit. It then also obviously means that you all have to work a bit later. In other words, you have to file a copy that's ready for the following morning. In the case of the Springboks this week, in fact, last week as well, because they've been based in Toulon, they're on this little peninsula called Sublettes, and the best way to get there from the port of Toulon is to take a ferry. So you need to coordinate your journey properly. It's about 18, 20 minutes on the ferry. You have to file copy, you have to hope you have signal while not getting too seasick. So yeah, it is what it is. I mean, I recall doing something fairly similar to the 2003 World Cup, where the Springboks stayed in Manly while the rest of us were in the Sydney CBD. So, yeah, you kind of roll with the tides, as it were.
Yeah. No, and it does sometimes get challenging. I mean, I remember in 2007 staying on the other side of Paris in La Défense, which is very far north, and then having to get to press conferences, and there's obviously deadline pressures and things like that. It's obviously always great to be there, but I think it is sometimes logistically a challenge, and it's been a challenge for us. Obviously, we want to record this as close to the Springbok team announcement as possible, when they have a 7 p.m. Press conference and you've still got to file copy for your newspaper, and it makes it quite a late night. It has been a bit of a challenge, but yeah, these challenges don't come around every day.
Yeah, look, it's also part of the fun. I mean, you kind of sometimes you run things very tight. You may be the last person on a train or the last person on a plane or a ferry, whatever the case may be. You may email something into the office, and the moment the thing says sent, you know that you're good to go. That's the most important thing almost of your day, that you were able to meet a deadline and do the stuff that you're supposed to be doing while you're on the move. So, yeah, look, it's part of the fun.
While we're on it, I mean, we're going to get to the Bok team announcement now, obviously, because that's the big news. But just how was the atmosphere at Marseille on Saturday? I take it you were there for the England game as well. So how was the atmosphere, and how's the atmosphere been in France? You know, for people who want to know, are the French people embracing it? I'm sure they are. We know they're very passionate people. But just how was it to be there in that stadium? It looked awesome.
Yeah, look, the England Argentina game was something else, and to be fair, that stadium, Stade Vélodrome, or Stade Marseille, as World Rugby calls it, they turn things around often to make it as sterile as possible. So, in the Stade Vélodrome, wonderful atmosphere. It's a great stadium. I love it. When France play there, they put on this show. It's lights, and it's the acoustics are great, and it's usually a wonderful occasion. A little bit toned down this time around for these World Cup matches, but still a wonderful atmosphere. I mean, the Argentinians, and there were a lot in town. They brought the party. They brought the geese. You could hear them singing on the metro as they disembarked trains. So they were in full voice, and then of course the England fans would respond with their swing low. But yeah, nice festive occasion, and while not as festive the next day, there was certainly a lot of patriotic fervour with the Scottish fans and the Springbok fans. So both marvellous occasions, and from all accounts, you know, at other venues as well, France has embraced this Rugby World Cup.
Now, let's get straight into the freshest news. Obviously, the Springbok team's been announced, 4 scrum-halves. We're going to start off with a clip of just Jacques Nienaber explaining why 4 scrum-halves, and get in his own words, and then we'll chat.
You're with Brendan Nell and Liam Delcom on the To The Last Drop podcast.
I think from the start, probably people were wondering why we were taking 4 scrum-offs. But I think if you look at the versatility within that 4 scrum-offs, that's probably what we saw. If you, Grant, for instance, he's played majority of his school career, not the majority, he played his school career at wing, and he only had, in the last couple of games of Paul Jim, he actually went to 9. And then, like you guys would have probably seen in the game that we played against New Zealand, a guy like Kubis can help us out at wing as well. And then, obviously, Fof, the majority of his school career, he played fly-off. And then he's also played fly-off for the Lions in the Super Rugby, and also for Sale Sharks in the Premiership. So if you look at, yes, there are 4 nines. They play majority of their rugby on a professional level at 9. But a lot of them have played in different positions, and that's nice for us. I think in the key thing of this game is that we can actually give Fof a run at 10, you know, which is, and I'm not being disrespectful at all to Romania or to the Test match, but it's an opportunity for us to try him out in a Test match under pressure at 10. Which obviously he's trained there for us numerous times, like in, I think when we selected Kanan at 13 before the All Black Test match, it's almost, listen, it's a little bit out of the box selection, but not Kanan has played 13 the majority of his school career, and then and he's trained with us there regularly, so we're confident and comfortable there. The same with Fof and the guys that we selected there. It's just like we've said it, that Fof is our third choice fly off, but this is a nice opportunity to give him a run at 10, controlling the game at 10 at test match level.
Well, Jacques then made the point there, you know, but that's, one shouldn't necessarily just look at them exclusively as scrum halves, but as versatile rugby players. I'm not going to repeat what he said, but certainly, I mean, it's probably just another way for the Springboks to sort of break with convention. They don't mind doing things a little differently and shake things up. The rest of the rugby world don't often follow. They, you know, they're not necessarily on the same page, and they find all these things very odd and curious. Whether it's a 6-2 split on the bench or 7-1 split on the bench, whether it's the use of lights from the coach's box, they always find a way to shake things up. And this is another example. I mean, I'm pretty sure somebody's going to have something to say about, you know, the fact that four scrum halves feature in the match day 20.
Well, that's what I wanted to come to. To me, I mean, the selection of Romania, we're always going to play a bunch of the fringe players in that game. It's the game to give all the extended squad a run. But the thing, I mean, just sitting from this side, the thing that I've just been laughing at the whole time is that every time we seem to do something or name a squad or go into a game, we have the rest of the world sort of gasping at, like, what are they doing now? You know, so all this pearl clutching going on across the world. And, you know, can they really do it? I saw an article yesterday where one of the Scottish journalists in the Times went and asked World Rugby, is it legal to use the traffic lights? Yeah, it's just, it's like you're keeping the rest of the world talking about everything else except the Springbok performance. And in a way, that's probably a good thing because the box quite enjoy that. Other teams are now being forced. I see the All Blacks were forced to answer a question about traffic lights now. And I'm sure this week they're all going to be asked about four scrum offs. So, you've got to give Russie and Jacques credit there. They keep keeping everyone guessing. And it's actually quite fun as a South African to watch, to be very honest.
Yeah, but then it diverts attention, not the Springboks' attention, because they've figured this thing out. It's, you know, the other teams, the commentators and so on, the pundits, to sort of figure out after the fact, you know, why are they doing this, and will it work? Is it legal, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, but it has been fun to observe.
You've been at the press conferences and that. Have you got the same sort of sense? Because obviously, social media can obviously be skewed at times, and we all watch social media, and the takes can be rather ludicrous on social media at times. Have you been getting the same sort of sense from journalists, especially the overseas journalists at the Springbok press conferences?
Only really after the Scotland game, there were a couple of Scottish journalists who they sort of pursued that line of interrogation about the lights. That was one feature. I remember Malcolm Marks in a mixed zone. A mixed zone basically is an area designated for quick interviews with the players as they leave the stadium, as they head for the bus. So you can have a quick 2-minute interview with a player. And he was pulled aside and asked about the use of lights. And he said, well, he doesn't really know, you know, how that system works. That's a communications tool used by, you know, the management. But he did make the point that it's difficult to, in that stadium in particular, to hear instructions. So even if they get to a line out, it's hard for the jumpers to sort of hear what he has to say and vice versa. So he kind of explained that element or that part of it. But yeah, no, that's only been at the game really that we, you know, journalists have asked those types of questions.
Talking about Malcolm, that's probably his best sidestep that he's ever done as well. He's not known for wading into controversy. He's a guy who likes to sort of, you know, step back, and he's not known for the big statements in interviews as well. His play on the field is obviously something else. But one thing people should realize about mixed zones as well, it's almost like a snake queue that you go through. Yeah. And you stand there and you obviously hope to catch them. And depending on how the team's done, obviously when they win, they're quite happy to talk with other guys. But I remember in 2015 when we'd lost to Japan, those guys were like Usain Bolt doing the snake queue. They couldn't, they sort of make as if they ignore you and they run past, you know. So it's always quite a gymnastics for a journalist to catch guys that mix zone, which makes it quite fun. But it's one of the unique things about a World Cup. So speaking of Marks, I'm going to ask you, I mean, obviously we've heard the stories about his injury. And there's a huge worry because he's such a big part of that Springbok team at the moment. What's the latest that you've heard?
Well, we obviously asked Jacques, what is the nature of the injury? How severe is it? And then he basically said the personal information, the Protection Act, the Poppy Act, precludes him from divulging that information. And it's basically the same line that he used when he announced the squad, when Luan de Jager wasn't named in the Springbok squad. So, you know, that's something that could become a little problematic going forward, because they could just pull that card. randomly going forward. So yeah, so we don't know a lot more. I do know that after in the game against Scotland, he left the field to get 3 stitches on his forehead. But I mean, that's obviously not the reason why he's gonna. Well, he's sitting out this week anyway. He wasn't going to be selected this week anyway, but that's why he's now sort of been consigned to the sidelines. So I'm sure we'll find out more in the coming days, but for the moment, it's all shrouded in a little bit of mystery.
Yeah, I suppose there's nothing like a World Cup without some angst about some injury somewhere along the line. And
and also in the case of Eben Etzebeth, that the 7 to 10 day prognosis that was. I think Rasmus spoke about that earlier in the week. That now looks like a 10 to 14 day return to play, possibly. So that puts him in real danger of missing the Ireland game. And in fact, I kind of got the sense that Jacques was sort of preparing people for that news when it ultimately comes, that Etzebeth probably won't play against Ireland.
Oh, that'd be huge. Especially, I mean, he's also such a heart of that Springbok pack as well. They've got depth, and I mean, it's not, I mean, as the Bok team always says, if someone's out, the next guy must just step up. But I mean, losing Etzebeth would be just, mentally just a huge blow in terms of the psychological stakes going into that game. And that's the thing. I mean, to me, just 2 things there. The Poppy Act. We see that it's almost become the favorite excuse of coaches now when they want to avoid a question. I'm not saying Jock might be very genuinely, not wanting to answer the question. And, it is a medical question, but yeah, the Etzebeth thing is a big, is a massive thing for the Box. And, I think this next week, they were always talking about all the talks being about injuries outside the tight 5, so that Andre Pollard or Lukanya can rejoin the squad. And now it seems like all the injuries have been in the tight 5. And luckily there is depth there, but it's not where you really want to have the pack have injuries.
No, I mean, the one of the Bok's strengths has been their depth. So you don't want to chisel away at that at all. A guy like Erge Snyman could, for instance, come in and deliver a masterclass. But again, I mean, if Etzebeth isn't there, then they don't have the depth in numbers. So yeah, that's something they will have to consider in the coming days.
Yeah.
If you look at the rest of that squad that was selected for Romania, a fairly inexperienced squad by their standards. I think in the last 2 years, there's only been 2 other teams that they've selected that has fewer caps in the starting lineup, and one was the defeat against Wales in Bloemfontein last year. And then earlier this year, the team that played and won in Buenos Aires also had fewer caps in the starting 15. So, by their standards, they usually put out a fairly experienced side. So by their standards, not a very experienced squad. But of course, we knew that they were going to go this route anyway.
Well, I suppose the danger there is because Ireland beat Romania by 80-odd points. Yeah, you don't exactly see them as a threat to the Springboks. So, first of all, you expect to win, and you expect to win quite well. So, you want to give everybody a run in that squad, and then obviously above that, you've got some team goals that you want to hit as well. The one guy that we're going to just listen to now as well is also the oldest man, Branas Dion Ferry, who has also he's going to be playing as reserve hooker there, and Marco van Staden was practicing this week, at this is like the emergency in case of emergency break glass hooker. So Eskom, there's some analogies you can make there.
I couldn't resist when we had Dion in our little media pod. He sat down for a few questions. I couldn't help but ask, given his advanced age, how much he remembers of Romania's game against the Springboks at the 1995 World Cup. And the first thing he said was like, who was the big fight again? Wasn't that against Canada?
I
don't remember anything of the Romania game.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to that clip quickly. And then also Dion just talking about how he still manages to go at the age of 36. And he's got almost 37. You're right.
In fact, I almost compared him to Lucy Jordan. At the age of 37, but I wouldn't necessarily do that to his face.
Yeah, you've got that. Last yesterday when I saw that team, I had there was another song in my mind, Kaiser Chiefs, I Predict a Riot, which is hopefully we'll see something like that. But listen to Dion, and yeah, we'll be back now talking about the rest of the games.
Do you remember anything from Romania's game against the Boks in 95?
I know, it was Canada, the big fight, eh? I can't remember. I was 9 years old, so it's, Yeah, I don't know. I can't put my finger on why I still feel good and still can run with the young Oaks. I don't know. Maybe I did gymnastics for 9 years and I'm not the biggest Oak doing all the weights in the gym, so probably I can ride it up to those two.
You're with Brendan Nell and Liam Delcom on the To The Last Drop podcast.
One of the things, Liam, that people don't also realize is that when you're traveling, because of the logistical nature of getting to games and the hours you have to get in before the games, etc., you guys don't really get to watch other games. And so it's the same in the November tours when they have these games back-to-back. You know, you tend to concentrate with all the press conferences and moving around that. That's pretty much your day. You didn't get to watch too many. And it's strange when people think you're at the World Cup, but you're not watching all these games as a fan would on TV.
You're actually going to end up watching a lot more than me. You're right. You're on the move and there are always other things to do. And as it turns out, I'm in an apartment now that doesn't have a television. So, and it's sometimes even when you have a television in your apartment, finding the right channel is often a challenge. So, you're going to have a far broader view of what's going on in terms of the on-field action than me.
Yeah, just on that, we'll go quickly run through the games of the first weekend. And a very strange format if you think of it, because the first weekend there was some epic, you know, box office type clashes. And now this weekend, it's almost the opposite. It's going to be a bunch of one-sided games coming up this weekend. Maybe Fiji, Australia, and maybe England, Japan, although I don't think Japan are quite at the level they were.
Japan doesn't have enough now.
Yeah. No. So, but I mean, and our game will be pretty one-sided, I reckon, as well. But yeah, obviously, let's start off with the big one, the opening one. You watched that in the pub, France, New Zealand. What impressed me was how France didn't play French rugby. How they kicked, 43 times. They gave away four penalties. They played almost Springbok rugby in that game against the All Blacks.
Yeah, and they've been doing this for a while with a little bit of variation. They're not scared to kick, let's be clear on that. They've also got to a formula where if they find that they can't breach the defense after three, maybe four phases, they're happy to apply the boot, especially against solid opposition, a team like the All Blacks, for instance, where if they turn it over, they become very dangerous. So France are then far more inclined to rather kick, play deep and let the All Blacks play from the back or kick back or whatever the case is. But in other words, they play the percentages. But we've seen that for a while, the fact that they apply the boot a lot. And they also play in a very measured way. They don't play 100 miles an hour all the time. They're quite happy to sit back. I mean, you'll recall in that game, they absorbed a lot of pressure early on. All Blacks threw a couple of punches, but, you know, France were able to absorb. I mean, they were it was that early try, but France were very much still in it. So they were able to weather that initial storm and then gradually turn the tide against the All Blacks. I thought from a game management point of view, they did very well. I mean, it looked all a bit nervy at the start, but the way they sort of pulled themselves together was quite impressive.
And yeah, I think best thing for the tournament as well, because it ignited probably the French public and sort of set the tone. So that's a great one. We had Argentina, England, which I know you were at as well. A huge disappointment to Argentina. They didn't fire a shot. It was almost as if they didn't know what to do with the ball. And England weren't great. Give George Ford his credit. I think England are better without Owen Farrell, to be very honest. But Argentina didn't fire a shot, and probably the disappointment of the weekend.
Yeah, you didn't expect that from a Michael Checker side. You'd expect them to show a bit of mongrel, a bit of fight, a bit of I almost used the word backbone. Yeah, so from that perspective, it was disappointing. You know, for a team that plays in the rugby championship, that, you know, that can roll the punches and, you know, stay in the contest, they didn't do any of that. And England, to be fair, once they were down to 14, they kind of, their focus was narrowed. They knew exactly what they had to do, and they stuck to that. So kudos to them. We saw similar elements, that sort of bulldog spirit, in their performance against Wales as well, in one of the warm-up games where they also lost, I think they had 12 players on the field at one point. And we saw it in that game because they also came back and actually won that game. So, you know, they're able to do that, but in terms of the general play, in terms of the attack, I just got the impression that, yeah, the England just, you know, they probably don't have the firepower to get to a final again. Maybe a semi-final, but not a final.
Yeah, no, I mean, Argentina were just, to me, were so poor that just, yeah, I think any team that just played them tactically right, like England did, took the points, kept the scoreboard ticking.
They frustrated them.
Yeah, and I think that's a huge worry for Argentina. Australia, Eddie kicked off with a win. He'll be very happy. They played Georgia exceptionally well. I also don't think they've got the, but I mean, teams in that side of the pool, you know, can start building momentum and that. And I think for Eddie, that was probably the best result. Yeah, Georgia's a strange team. They can cause you problems. But yeah, Australia played them tactically exceptionally well as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And also just will probably give that squad just a little bit of belief, because the Wallabies did look like a team that was devoid of that. They looked like a team that was, they were yet to buy into what Eddie Jones had to offer. And, you know, maybe this will help galvanize them. Yeah, that was certainly, it wasn't a performance that, you know, we rated 5 stars, but it was good enough.
Yeah, the game you probably didn't see, the Wales Fiji game, probably the game of the weekend.
Yeah, everybody talks about that.
it was an unbelievable game, and Fiji did unbelievably well. Except that, you know, a lot has been made about you know, how Wales got away with a lot of stuff in the 22, and it was rather apparent when you give away 5-6 penalties in your 22, and you only get a warning, and the first rolling ball in Fiji's 22 gets a yellow card. You know, there are some questions about referees there, that but that tends to happen in World Cups. Sometimes it goes for you, and I don't think we must delve too much on the refs. We've still got a long tournament to go, but Fiji were unlucky. And the only thing I would say for them is that I looked at the stats afterwards. They had a 65% tackle rate, and that for Test match rugby is way too low. And if they can up that, they can beat other teams, and they can cause Australia some problems because they've got the physicality for that. But you know, when you're missing tackles like that, you can't really complain about. Things that we need to do. So, and then the final game that we're going to talk about, because our time is starting to run out, is obviously the beautiful win over Scotland, which I must admit, to me, and this is maybe just sitting here, but we heard the whole week about how Scotland were going to run the box off their feet. How are they going to do, you know, upset the box? And it was almost as if, maybe not the rest of the rugby world, but the rest of the home nations and all the writers we read in the Northern Hemisphere, sort of, we're almost willing that to happen. And I just thought the Box were exceptional in terms of their defense. I thought they cut off Finn Russell's oxygen superbly. There wasn't, other than maybe 2 line breaks and the 2 scrum penalties, there wasn't really anything that Scotland threatened the Box with. And of course, when the Box got their chance, they weren't perfect. They got a lot to work on, but they did more than enough to win that game comfortably. And I know it was a tense game and a tricky game, but I really thought the Box were quite dominant.
Yeah, it was only around halftime where we felt that it was a bit tight and tense. And as the players came back for the second half, you know, it was sort of dragged into the unknown a little bit. But then, you know, soon after halftime, the Box made a clear statement. And it was always going to be very difficult for Scotland to get traction after that. So it was a professional performance. We, again, in that game, probably a refereeing decision or two that was putting sharp focus afterwards. And in fact, refereeing is also one of the things that the World Cup bosses were dragged into, you know, conversation that they were dragged into yesterday. where they had to talk about refereeing on the opening weekend. They had to talk about access to stadiums, which was problematic in Marseille and Bordeaux. They had to talk about a beer not being readily available at some of the venues because they have an associate sponsor that's supposed to supply.
Jeez, Liam, we should have started with that. That's the horror story of the World Cup. We should have started. If there's no beer, jeez, I'd be very...
Well, I'm working, Brendan, so, you know, those people have to fight their own fights. And there was an assault in Bordeaux, quite a disturbing one, on a fan. And, they were to address all these matters at a press conference yesterday. So, you know, at least they, you know, aware of these things and working towards finding a solution. But I think when it comes to refereeing, we kind of predicted, we knew a long time ago that, you know, there were going to be issues. And it doesn't speak to the quality of refereeing or officiating. It speaks to, I think in most cases, there is a lack of clarity, when it comes to certain issues, especially when it comes to, head-high tackles or contact, because it's not adequately explained. And I think fans will continue to find that very frustrating.
Yeah, and I think to me, I think that's one of the biggest problems rugby has is that, you know, where you should be educating fans, where you should be making the game more accessible. Rugby tends to sort of stick its head in the sand, and you know, you get a disciplinary decision or you don't get a disciplinary decision. But this weekend alone, there were three different incidents of head knocks. One was a red card. Jesse Krill wasn't even cited, and there was another one. And without going into the merits of all of those, you would expect World Rugby just to explain to fans why the one was cited, why the other one wasn't cited. Yeah. And I mean, we could spend hours on just debating that alone in rugby, and that's part of the problem.
And the thing for me is if you expect fans to travel thousands of miles and part with hard-earned money to go and watch these games and people having to buy decoders and they watch it on television, you know, if there is that expectation, the very least they can do is to be transparent and explain things like this, because it is, of course, still be a talked about topic. It's the decent thing to do.
Yep. No, exactly. And then, of course, you wouldn't know that, but all sort of discussion on social media was hit by a massive copyright strike by World Rugby. So all these guys sharing clips and debating it on social media suddenly had their clips removed. And that's just ridiculous. Anyway, but saying that, Liam, you've got a very long journey ahead of you to Bordeaux. I think we've chatted a lot. We'll be back next week. There'll be a lot to talk about again. And I'm sure we can easily fill a couple of these shows, but travel well, and I'm jealous. And please make sure that you live the big life for all of us.
Well, I'll try and catch this train. This is my first priority now. So we'll chat later.
Cool. Chat to you next week.
Thanks for listening. And a reminder: you can find all the To the Last Drop podcasts on the Brendan Nell YouTube channel, Iono.fm, Spotify, Player.fm, Pocket Casts, Google Podcasts, and iTunes, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts.